man. When Nebuchadnezzar came to Jerusalem and set Hezekiah as king in place of his brother, and he took hostage 10,000 of the chief or principal men of Jerusalem. A lot of them were just young men, scholars, students, craftsmen, like carpenters and stoneworkers and things like that. Some of them were government officials and noblemen. And he took them all back to Babylon as hostages. Daniel and Ezekiel were both in that crowd. Daniel and his two companions that we know early from the book of Daniel. And I believe that Susanna was the introduction to Daniel, that what we see in Susanna introduced a young Daniel as a righteous man to the community of Judah in Babylon. That's my opinion, that that book is legitimate, and that should be chapter one of Daniel. It should have been. And as we saw last week in Ralph Septuagint and certain other publications of Daniel, it is chapter one of Daniel. Susanna is placed before chapter one of Daniel in Ralph's edition of the Septuagint, not in Brenton's. So that's about all I would have to say. So we've already done Susanna. So I believe that Susanna is at least one event, if not the signal event, that gave the young Daniel his reputation. And when I say young, I mean as young as 30. I don't think he was younger than that when he gained his reputation, but it's possible. It is possible. So that's all I could say.
Okay, Daniel chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem, and besieged it. And Yahweh gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, with part of the vessels of the house of God, the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God. And the king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel, and of the king's seed, and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well favored, and skillful in all wisdom, and cunning in knowledge, and understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat, and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end thereof they might stand before the king. Now among these were of the children of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, unto whom the prince of the eunuchs gave names. For he gave unto Daniel the name of Belteshazzar, and to Hananiah of Shadrach, and to Mishael of Meshach, and to Azariah of Abednego. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. End of verse 8.
That phrase, understanding science, cunning in knowledge and understanding science, science isn't really a good translation there. That's the way the King James translators chose to render it, but it's just discernment or knowledge. It's really a synonym of the word translated as knowledge, which is knowledge. Knowledge, perception, discernment, understanding, wisdom, and then that's da'af. And then science is translated from a word mada, which is knowledge, thought, discernment. It's basically a synonym. I would translate it knowledge and discernment, probably, or something like that, but I wouldn't translate it as science, so to speak, as we know the word science. That word Belshazzar, or Belteshazzar, Lord of the Straitened Treasure. So Daniel is basically given a title there. Lord of the Straitened Treasure, Daniel was made Lord of the treasure of those whom the Babylonians had in captivity. That's what that means. Shadrach is royal or great scribe. And Meshach is guest of the king, and Abednego is servant of Nebo, who's one of the gods of Nebuchadnezzar, and it's actually the family god of Nebuchadnezzar, which is why he's called Nebuchadnezzar. So what we have here is titles. I would say under whom the prince of the eunuch gave titles, which are offices or positions. And these men must have had certain roles to fill in the fulfillment of these offices that they were assigned. They're being assigned offices here. They're not being renamed with cool sounding names that the Babylonians like better. These are titles.
So perhaps Daniel was a treasurer or something of the sort?
Yeah. Daniel was a treasurer, and Hananiah became a scribe. Which is Shadrach, and Mishael became, that just says guest of the king, so that's obscure. And Azariah became Abednego, which is servant of a god, right? So maybe the roles of Mishael and Azariah aren't as defined as those of Daniel and Hananiah, but that they're all roles that they would have had functions to fulfill.
User disconnected from your
which
channel.
Would be their work for Nebuchadnezzar, for his court.
I find it interesting that the Babylonians were just at war with Judah not many years ago, and now they're giving these men, you know, positions of authority. Like that displays quite a degree of trust.
It also shows that the Edomic empires were quite noble. Today, if someone takes an enemy, they put them in prison and treat them really badly.
Yeah.
Like these ancient, and this was what the Gold Empire, wasn't
User
it?
Entered your channel.
So to be under an Aryan society, in Aryan bondage is nowhere near as bad as being under Jewish bondage, because our people are more noble. They took these men captive and then made them skillful in wisdom and cunning and knowledge so that they could appear before their king. That's quite noble.
It is noble. And all right, I know the Romans did the same thing, right? The Romans would take hostages from a subject nation and they would take them back to Rome. And they would educate them in Rome. Usually they were young men. Sometimes they were a little older. They would educate them in Rome and Romanize them to try to make them friendly to Rome so that they would have permanent allies in that subject nation.
Yeah, so they had like a meritocracy. Even when you were in bondage to these people, being an Edomic society, they still had a meritocracy where they wanted the best at the top of their society, and they did things to make sure their society was strong. Today we have a dysgenic society where we promote the sick and the demented and the sodomites and all that to the top of society. It's very different being under, you know, Satan than it is being under the beast empires of that were Edomic. And one other thing I noticed. Oh, go ahead, Bill.
I just want to say, if you read the book of Tobit, Tobit actually had a
He had
a lot of free reign. He lived in Nineveh, which was the capital city of the Assyrians. And he had a lot of free reign, and he went where he wanted to go. He did many alms deeds for his brethren. I'm trying to look at the beginning of Tobit. I think he had some kind of appointment or high job in Nineveh. I'm trying to look for it. It's very vague in my memory what Tobit did, but he wasn't a pauper in Nineveh. He was a very successful man that lived as a captive, an Israelite captive in Nineveh, the capital city of the Assyrians. He continued to tithe to Jerusalem, according to this.
And the other thing is at verse 4, it says, children in whom was no blemish. And I'm wondering if that's racial. But so they're looking for people who are smart and skillful in wisdom, but also had no blemish. You know, that's interesting to me. You know, in the dictionaries, it says, probably meaning a stain, physical or moral. So it's not necessarily racial, but...
It's not necessarily... Blemish there probably means no disabilities, right? I mean, I don't think they would get disqualified for having a mole or a wart or a freckle. I think it really meant that they have no disabilities or obvious physical problems. That would be my opinion of that from the Babylonian viewpoint.
Would it be the same for the Levites too?
It could be. I mean, it could be.
But a moral stain too. I mean, it could be a moral stain, like they're not sodomites or sort of pervert or something.
A blemish, because the Old Testament law rejects even cowards, right? Or men that are soft.
Oh, I meant the Babylon. I meant the Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon here. I know Noble mentioned the Levites, but I was still thinking of, you know, these Babylonians aren't going to accept sodomites or anything like that. Moral blemishes.
Well, I really do believe the Book of Nezra was a Chaldean and that he was a white man. I don't believe that he was a Canaanite. But there is evidence even in inscriptions that the Assyrians and Babylonians had mingled in early times. I don't know if I could extend that to the Chaldeans, but I wouldn't doubt it, that it were mingling with the Canaanite population. Every empire does it.
When Herodotus wrote about them, though, mentioned that they dressed like women, they all had long hair, they had horns on their heads. It was really like they really dressed strange and
user entered your channel.
Freaks do today.
Well, I don't know how much of that is true and how much of it is basically war propaganda, so to speak, but the Greeks did generally see the people of the East, especially the Persians, as being effeminate and having gotten effeminate because of their wealth.
Yeah, like by the time Herodotus was writing, we're talking
200 years after the Book of Nezra almost.
Yeah, and then also like with the Persians, the Greeks would have been writing during the Hellenistic period of describing the Persians like that when they had been rich for too long, right?
Yes.
Yeah, but sorry, you said 200, and it's Herodotus was
Yeah, he was probably about 170 years after this. After this episode?
Yeah.
The Book of Nezra ruled, I think, until about 560 something, so that would be about 130 years. It's still a while.
Yeah. I mean, it just goes to show it's the same thing that's happening to our society.
It happens to every society, to every empire. This is a bitch society. It really is. Look at these clowns that Drowdy's always fucking with on YouTube. This meth mouth that I posted on today, this morning. He actually thinks he's tough. He's going to come down here and with a rope and put me in a bay or something. Has he ever faced a real man before? Probably never. Look at him. He looks like a girl. He has the physique of a woman. He's really going to beat me up and put a rope around me? Come on. But he can run his mouth like that on social media. Of course he's not going to do it. And if he tried, he'd be in big trouble. But he can run his mouth like that on social media. Today is, we are so debauched today beyond the ancient Persians. We are so effeminized beyond the ancient Persians. When a bitch that can't lift his own weight thinks he's going to just take another man and hang him from a rope. I mean, come on. What the hell is he thinking? I don't get it, because he's a girl. He's got the physique of a woman. So they think they're tough because they could slap around a joystick? That's what it comes down to, and that's the way it is today. It's a commentary on the times.
It's also like he's getting upset over, like, emotional because you don't believe in flat earth. Like, why can't he be a man and, like, make objective arguments? Why doesn't he have a masculine personality where he says, I see where you're coming from. Now, I think my position is the stronger position because this, this, and that. You know, he's not, right. He doesn't think like a man.
No, thinks like a girl.
He just gets offended straight away and then starts chucking a tantrum and is, you know. Oh, well. How about verse 9, Noble?
Sure. Verse 9. Now God had brought Daniel into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. And the prince of the eunuchs said unto Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who has appointed your meat and your drink. For why should he see your faces worse, liking than the children which are of your sort? Then shall you make me endanger my head to the king. Then said Daniel to Melzar, whom the prince of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, prove your servants, I beseech thee, 10 days, and let them give us pulse to eat and water to drink. Then let our countenances be looked upon before thee, and the countenance of the children that eat of the portion of the king's meat. And as thou seest, deal with thy servants. So he consented to them in this matter, and proved them 10 days. And at the end of the 10 days, their countenances appeared fairer and fatter in flesh than all the children which did eat the portion of the king's meat. Thus Melzar took away the portion of their meat and the wine that they should drink, and gave them pulse. As for these 4 children, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now at the end of the days that the king had said he should bring them in, then the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king communed with them, and among them all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in all his realm. And Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus. End of chapter 1.
Yeah, you know, we have to imagine, and I do, that anybody who's really studied in the scriptures and can answer everyday questions or solve everyday problems, theological problems, philosophical problems, problems or issues about morality from the Word of God is better, 10 times better than any magician or astrologer, for certain.
Oh, yeah.
So the vegetable thing, I don't know, man. I've seen vegetarians that were kind of like wasted away. But this word for pulse, It's not just vegetables. This word for pulse is zeraon, and it's the word zera with a slightly different form, grammatical form. I want to see the actual form, so I got to switch over and find it in Hebrew. Okay. Zereonim is the actual form, but that word zera means seed at its most basic level, and it means to seed, to scatter seed as a verb. It's to scatter seed or to sow. So this isn't necessarily just vegetables, but it's, to me, it's grain, right? They were eating grain, whether it be oatmeal porridge, cream of wheat, grits, whatever. Well, it wasn't grits because they didn't have maize, but whatever, right? It's some kind of seed that they were eating, which is probably higher in protein than green leafy vegetables, right? So I would understand the vegetables as seed.
If it were vegetables, we could conjecture that perhaps the vegetables of their day were higher quality than today.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Well, yeah, I would believe that, because the ones today are just like factory produced vegetables in soil that's like artificially fertilized with tons of nitrogen that comes from Russia for the most part. Well, yeah, I mean, the farming today is fake. And it's vegetables that are grown in organic, natural soil are far superior, but we don't buy those vegetables at the supermarket.
You know what else is, if you think of Hitler, right? So food was also still natural back in his day, and he didn't drink any alcohol either, because they're also not drinking wine. They just drank water. And he always had a very healthy look about him. So, you know, a guy like today that would only eat vegetables from the supermarket and drink water would probably not look anything like that.
Yeah, you know, I have known a few total vegetarians in my life, and they were all skinny, wimpy-looking knaves, right? They were waifs. Waif is the word I'm looking for, W-A-I-F. They were waifs. They were, wow.
Yeah, and also the land that it's grown on would have been much richer than the farmland that we have, among other things.
Right. Well, there's no doubt to me that it's better to eat just porridge than to eat unclean. Like the Babylonians were probably eating all the shellfish and shrimp, lobster, clams, whatever they could get out of the sea, conch, whatever.
User entered your channel.
And it was pork. We see swine raising in Old Testament and New by the non-Israelite tribes. So it was by a lot of swine. And it was simply unclean. So yeah, I wouldn't blame Daniel for not wanting to eat that. I went through prison eating tuna fish and peanut butter because I didn't want to eat their bullshit. So I didn't suffer for it. I was actually in pretty good shape. So I could understand that, eating just pulse. And that's realistic, especially at that time when farming was organic. They had no artificial means of farming that we know of. It was definitely organic. And the grain was probably a lot better too.
Couldn't have God help them too, you know, so that they had a good countenance and that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, we could think of it that way, but would he really have to? I don't know. I can't answer that, of course.
I would conjecture that Yahweh would bless us just by following his food laws, like cause and effect.
Yeah.
One more, you know, maybe this is a spurious comment, but the eunuch seems more masculine than most government officials today. You know, even the eunuch seems more masculine because he's quite objective. When they ask him, when they beseech him, he doesn't chuck a, you know, he doesn't get all angry. He just says, okay, I'll give you the 10 days. And at the end of the 10 days, we'll see. whereas most government officials today are, they get offended easily, they're control freaks and so on.
Yeah, but also in verse 9, it was Yahweh who brought Daniel into favor with this. I'm saying that that's an extra, I mean, he, it says that.
Oh yeah. I see that now, yeah.
Verse 21, I guess, is pretty much definitely a scribal interpolation, right?
Yes, I would believe so. Especially since in Daniel chapter 10, it refers to the third year of Cyrus. But it even says the first year of Cyrus in the Septuagint. So it's a scribal interpolation that evidently was made at a very early time. But the Septuagint says, whoa. Okay, Theodosian Septuagint says the third year of King Cyrus in Daniel chapter 10, but the traditional Septuagint translation, I should say Theodosian's Greek translation, the traditional Septuagint says in the first year of Cyrus in Daniel chapter 10. So that means that in Daniel chapter 10, there was a divergence among the Hebrew manuscripts before the time of Theodosian. And the Masoretic text follows the divergent manuscripts. In other words, this traditional Septuagint was translated by all accounts. I can't prove it, right? But by all accounts, probably between 280 and 250 BC. Let's say 280 BC, right? I think it was in the time of Ptolemy Lagus. It's accredited by Josephus, so that might even be a little earlier. Let me see. Okay, he died in 282 BC, so it's a little earlier. So the traditional Septuagint was translated before 282 BC. And Daniel chapter 10 says, in the first year of King Cyrus. But Theodosian made his translation in the middle of the second century AD, over 300 years later, over 400 years later. So he has, in the third year of King Cyrus. Yes, Theodosian. So that tells me that it was a divergence in the Hebrew manuscripts between the time that the original Septuagint was translated and the time of Theodosian when he translated his own manuscripts into Hebrew manuscripts, his copy of the Hebrew manuscripts into Greek, right? There must have been a divergence in at least some of the Hebrew manuscripts in Daniel chapter 10, verse 1.
Interesting.
And the Masoretic text followed those divergent manuscripts because it has in the third year of Cyrus, Daniel 10:1, but the traditional Septuagint has the first year of Cyrus.
Brenton has the third year too.
And that means that the Codex Vaticanus that he followed, I think it was the Vaticanus, must have had the third year. But does he have a note there for the Alexandrinus? Does he have any critical note there?
Oh, I don't have my hard copy.
I'm going to get Ralph's first, just for the hell of it. Daniel chapter 10, verse 1. NLC, this verse here, if that's in a text, it probably is, I'm sure. Yes, it is. First year of Cyrus. All right, Daniel 10, verse 1 in Ralph's. He has in the first year of Cyrus in the hard copy. And he has a note. And he has a complete alternate reading from, and it's from Theodotion. He supplies Theodotion's readings of Daniel, I guess. Yeah, he does. I didn't know that because I hadn't gotten to Daniel yet in Ralph's. I only use it as a reference, and I haven't really read it yet. Parts of it. So he follows Theodotion. He offers Theodotion's Daniel on the bottom half of the page and the Sethergen Daniel on the top half in Daniel. And I guess they do that because Theodotion's Daniel is so different than the traditional Sethergen's Daniel. But the traditional Sethergen, according to Ralph's, has the first year of Cyrus. Brenton. Got to find Daniel. Almost. Third year of Cyrus, and he has no critical note. I mean, Brenton's critical notes are not very numerous. They're actually pretty sparse, but he did make critical notes of a lot of important differences, and for some reason, not this one. Like Brenton tells you, the Codex Alexandrinus has angels in Genesis 6:2 instead of sons of God, things like that. So he did make critical notes, but he didn't make many. Which is sad. Even Ralph's really doesn't have a lot of critical notes. But part of that might be, he has a lot more than Brenton does, don't get me wrong, but part of that might be that there really aren't a whole lot of old editions of the traditional Sethergen that have survived to us. So he has some critical notes for the beginning of Genesis chapter 10, but the only thing he offers for 10:1 is Theodotion's reading, which says the third year of Cyrus, just like the Masoretic text. But in any event, whether it's the third year of Cyrus or the first, and I'm sure it should probably say the first. Oh, wow, my Bible Works crashed and disappeared. I've been having that problem. That the whether it's the first or the third, this does, Noble, this does seem to be added by a later hand. I mean, how does Daniel know in 590-something BC or whenever this is that he would be living and continuing to the first year of Cyrus in what, which is kind of like the first year of Cyrus from the Babylonian viewpoint is the year that Babylon was conquered by Cyrus. It was really about the 10th year or 12th year of Cyrus's reign, but the Babylonians would call it the first year of Cyrus, and that would be 540, 539 BC, something like that.
Yeah, I feel like we see interpolations like this often in the Old Testament, because often you see it say something along the lines of even unto this day and stuff like that.
Yeah, right. And they're all later interpolations by a scribe that thought he had to comment on one scripture or another. And we even see them in the books of Moses. We see them. I mean, Ezra the scribe is credited with generally with compiling, collecting the scriptures and compiling them, the Old Testament scriptures. And that's very possible, and it is plausible. We even see in the days of Josiah, probably 100 years before Ezra, or close, maybe 80 years, in the days of Josiah, that the scriptures were neglected and in disarray. They had to blow the dust off the cover of the Book of the Law, if you remember, in Josiah. Mm-hmm. So after the destruction of Samaria, the destructions of all the synagogues of northern Israel by the Assyrians, and then the Babylonians come and they hold up the people of Jerusalem in town while they destroy and deport the rest of Judah. Yeah, I could see where the records might get in disarray and probably have to be recompiled when the dust settles, friggin' 70 years later, 80 years later, whatever.
Whoever compiled Daniel really messed up, though.
They messed up Daniel. They messed up Jeremiah, and they messed up parts of Ezekiel.
Yep.
The chapter orders are all screwed up. It's especially obvious in Daniel, though. It really is. Because he has a Babylonian king, and he has a Persian king, and he's back to a Babylonian king, and it's like, what the hell? This ain't the way history unfolded. It's obvious the chapters are out of order.
I feel like maybe Yahweh lets this happen deliberately. Like it's a part of his will because it's like an exercise. He doesn't want us to be lazy. He wants us to work for it, pay attention.
Yeah, it's like when the Book of the Law went missing, that probably wasn't an accident because they didn't care about the law anymore. And then suddenly a king who cares about the law, they suddenly find the law again in the temple. You know, that's not a coincidence.
Right.
Should I continue with chapter 2?
Why not?
Daniel chapter 2. And in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams, wherewith his spirit was troubled, and his sleep brake from him.
Microphone.
Then the king commanded to call the magicians, and the astrologers, and the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans, for to show the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king. And the king said unto them, I have dreamed a dream, and my spirit was troubled to know the dream. Then spoke the Chaldeans to the king in Syriac, O king, live forever. Tell thy servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, The thing is gone from me. If you will not make known unto me the dream, with the interpretation thereof, you shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made a dunghill. But if you show the dream and the interpretation thereof, ye shall receive of me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore show me the dream and the interpretation thereof. They answered again and said, Let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation of it. The king answered and said, I know of certainty that you would gain the time, because you see the thing is gone from me. But if you will not make known unto me the dream, there is but one decree for you. For you have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me, till the time be changed. Therefore tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me the interpretation thereof. The Chaldeans answered before the king and said, There is not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter. Therefore there is no king, lord, nor ruler, that asked such things at any magician, or astrologer, or Chaldean. And it is a rare thing that the king requires, and there is none other that can show it before the king, except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. For this cause the king was angry and very furious, and commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. And a decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they sought Daniel and his fellows to be slain. End of verse 13.
Now there's another anomaly here in the dating, because in Daniel chapter 1, all sources inform us that Nebuchadnezzar came to Judah and took captives in the third year of, in the third year of Jehoiakim. Okay. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, under Jerusalem and besieged it. Okay, I misread that. But this is only the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. And that seems kind of early to me. That's why I thought it was an anomaly. So this would be 605 or 604, possibly, B.C. And that's a little earlier than I thought. Daniel and his friends were taken hostage and the 10,000 princes. Perhaps my memory is just foggy, but that's okay. That's fine.
I feel like this is a mark of a true prophet here, because even today, say like you have a dream and you go to a psychic or something, and you're like, hey, psychic middle-aged woman, I dreamt about a polar bear last night. Tell me what it means. And she'll be like, oh, the polar bear represents your inner struggles. Or you can go to the psychic right and be like, I had a dream. It really troubled me. I can't remember it. Interpret the dream. And they're like, I can't help you. I don't know.
My trick doesn't work when you don't tell me, when you don't help me a little bit.
Exactly, right? So here it really shows the difference between Daniel, a prophet of Yahweh, and then all these magicians and other people.
Well, a lot of men claim to be prophets, and they only get something right every 100 guesses, basically.
There's those psychics that do that cold reading where they'll say, I'm getting a feeling. Is there someone with the name JB? Oh, I know a JB. You. I'm connecting into you. And then they start picking out all this stuff and they go, I've lost it. Or that you know what's it called? Cold reading. So it sounds like they're doing a bit of cold reading, maybe. That's what they were.
There's nothing new under the sun.
I don't know what these Chaldeans are, though, because you've got magicians, astrologers, sorcerers, and the Chaldeans. Like, the Chaldeans, that's a national identity. So it just seems strange that you've got astrologers, magicians, and Chaldeans. Like, why would he call upon the Chaldeans?
Microphone.
I don't know what that means. Maybe that means the chief men of the Chaldeans.
No, I think he's just saying, like, there isn't an astrologer, there isn't a magician, or any Chaldean that can help me. He's saying the whole group, the whole ethnicity, there's no man. He's kind of like ascending to not just you guys, but no Chaldean. That's how.
Well, this defines Chaldean as inhabitants of Chaldea, but that's not really true. The Chaldeans were Nebuchadnezzar's particular tribe of people,
yeah,
who had conquered Babylonia and taken it over for themselves at an earlier time than this.
Yeah, this word for magician, I'm only getting magician, but I kind of feel like that's just another word in the ancient world that for scientists today. Because these days, we would definitely lump in an astrologer, or not an astrologer, but somebody into astronomy as a scientist. I just feel like every time I've ever read anything about magicians in the ancient world, they're just people that understood a certain science, like how to change a certain chemical into another chemical or whatever, mix chemicals and so forth.
Chartam, I don't know, there's only 5 examples of the word in the Old Testament, so it's kind of hard. I would have to study the associated words or the root words, which I haven't done. Astrologer here is defined as a conjurer or enchanter.
Because, I mean, there's an absence for a particular word for scientists other than people with knowledge, right? I don't know, like Pharaoh's magicians, you know, turning that snake, the rod into a snake. You know, it was, I mean, that's the kind of thing that science does these days, right? It's just little tiny tricks that it's not really all that complicated, you know? Any guy in Las Vegas on the strip that is a magician for a living can probably do that today, right? Make you think that a snake, a rod turn into a snake.
Okay, well, I mean, I don't try because I don't like snakes. No, I wouldn't try. I have no reason to try that goofy shit. Here the word for magician was translated simply into what Hebrew has magician, it was simply translated as wise man. But astrologer was translated as magi, which are the magi are that priesthood that was also found among the Medes and the Persians that the Greeks called the magi. And Chaldean is Chaldean in the Greek. It's an ethnic word that wasn't translated. It was only transliterated. And it's I don't know why it's Chaldean, because it was Caste in Hebrew, Caste or Casti. And oftentimes that's transliterated as Cassites in American or European archaeological literature. But Caste was the Chaldeans.
Yeah, and you see magi in the word magician, so I don't know if there's a relationship there.
Yeah, well, I think that's where the English word magician must have come from, through Greek literature, from that word from magi. Because it wasn't a magi in Hebrew, it was a kartam or a kartom, which is supposedly an Aramaic word, according to Strong's. I can look in Strong's and see if there's any related Hebrew words. Let me do that.
You have to give credit to the King of Babylon for wanting to kill all the wise men. That's pretty good. Like when he says he's going to clear out the swamp, he actually does it.
Yeah, right. 2749. Kartom, the same as 2747. Kind of. Which is just cart, just the cart part, or karet is Strong's. It doesn't have the M on the end. Which is a primitive root meaning to engrave, a chisel or graver, also a style for writing. So it's somebody that engraves or writes with an engraving tool. It's a freaking scribe. It ain't necessarily a magician.
Yeah, it sounds like a scientist, because that's all they do is they write stuff and then people believe it, right? Like today.
Well, it's a scribe. I would say a scribe or some kind of writer, because it was translated as wise man in the Septuagint in Greek.
Like, it just seems to me like every pagan society, including the one we live in, considers a wise man to be a man of science. So it make you know that they would call them wise men just like people do today.
Right. The literal Hebrew would be an engraver. But of course, Strong's has magician, a horoscopist, as drawing magical lines or circles. That to me is conjecture. I could see what 2748-49. I could see what Jesenius says. Just for the hell of it. I usually expect a little better from Jesenius, but I don't always get a little better. 2748. He has 2747, the same as Strong's does, a graving tool or a style with which letters were inscribed on wood or stone. Hence, poetically used of a kind of writing, And that's in Isaiah chapter 80 as a citation for that, which seems to make sense. And then in 27:48 for this word, because 747 is the verb, right? Or the tool, I'm sorry, it's the tool. 27:48, kartom, he translates it as, he defines it as sacred scribes. And that makes sense. Where Strong's definition just kisses the King James's ass. And it doesn't really make sense.
Did you say a political form of writing? Is that what he wrote?
No, a poetic form of writing.
Oh, poetic, okay. I was going to say,
So it makes sense to me that Cartone would refer to sacred scribes in this context. That makes sense. Rather than magicians, right? They're sacred scribes. And it's just a wise man in Greek, the way it's translated. So it's, that would be a sacred scribe, those who write for the kingdom, the king, whatever.
Yeah, and you often describe scientists today as the priests of society. So that would make sense, the sacred scribe.
Yeah, well, scientists today are the high priests of our society. That should be really clear. Just look at the whole COVID thing. It's right there. I mean, I said it years ago, but look at the COVID thing.
Yeah, Fauci is the high priest in the temple right now.
Yeah. He's the official high priest of the king, who's dictating the medical, or I should say sorcery activities, the pharmaceutical activities of the people. Yeah, it's crazy. But that's
so
what they
are. I got a question. So are we trying to say that there aren't people with supernatural abilities?
There aren't people with supernatural abilities?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what? I don't know if there are people with supernatural abilities because I never met one. And the ones I think I've seen were all frauds.
Yeah. There was this guy that... that I, when I was managing that restaurant that I used to hire, and he built himself as a musical mentalist, and this guy would have people come up to him, and he would have them think of a song in their head, write down a song, put it in the palm of their hand, and then he put his hand on their hand or on their arm, and he would tell them the song that they were thinking in their head. And then they would, and it was the same song that they had written on the piece of paper. He used to do like crazy stuff like that.
Okay, well, I'm not going to try to explain that unless he could do it to me.
Martin's comment does make me think of something, though, and that's those two magicians in Exodus when Moses, through Yahweh, does a wonder, it often says that they did the same thing.
Right, and they were able to do that, to conjure, and they probably had some knowledge that's lost to us today, and I don't doubt the veracity of the scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
But if they could be prophets and seers, where are they? Because Yahweh said that we wouldn't have any.
Yeah, they got it. Well, that's what I mean, though, that science does create things that we would associate with supernatural, right?
Does it?
Well, I mean, some people would. I'm not saying we would, but generally speaking, society today, which worships these scientists, believe that they can do wonders. Like people always say, the miracles of modern science, right? People are fascinated with the things they're doing. So in a way, they are just magicians. I just think that that's what is... I think that my original point was, I think magicians in those days are really scientists, what we call scientists today.
Well,
because they're viewed as.
I'm sure there's some overlap there. I wouldn't doubt that at all. Since science, it is an attempt to understand the elements and the world around us, I wouldn't doubt at all that the magicians would have to.
Yeah,
have to master that. I'm sure that if you went into the midst of some primeval tribes in South America or the Canadian Rockies or wherever you might find them, Inuit up there in with the Eskimos, or the center of Africa with your magic fire stick and pointed at an elephant and killed it, that they probably bend over and worship you because you killed an elephant with a magic fire stick, right? I mean, yeah, but to us, it's just a rifle.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, they were, you know, it's the way that society views what people are doing, which gives them these titles.
Well, one thing I know the Babylonians did, and early kings worked with the priests so that the priests would be able to control the people and obey the king, that they'd be able to tell the movements, foretell the times of eclipses and things like that, so that the people would hold them in awe. But they were really just doing mathematical calculations to figure out when the next lunar eclipse would be or solar eclipse. So having command of science gives you power over people. Or pretending to. And people believe that shit, and they believe anything they read on TV, everything they watch on TV about science, they believe. Oh, I saw it on a science channel. I know it's true. Okay, whatever.
Yeah, it even leads to arguments, because one guy will see one thing on a science channel, another guy will see another thing, and then they're trying to argue where neither of them has any context at all to understand what they're arguing about. You know, it's just what the television told them.
Well, in any event, these should be sacred scribes and soothsayers, probably, rather than astrologers, soothsayers, conjurers, which would be sorcerers. The word is usually translated as, it only appears six times according to this, and it's always translated as astrologer. I guess astrology is a type of conjurer, but an astrologer, but there were other types of conjurers besides astrologers in the ancient world. That's 826. Let me see what Jesenius has to say about that, since I got the book open. I'm almost there. He has enchanter or magician, where it says astrologer here. And that same word was Hebrew and Chaldee. I'll bet a lot of those words are Hebrew and Chaldee, because the Chaldeans are... I really believe that the Chaldeans came from northern Syria, and that they're from probably what's a combination, an amalgamation of Aram and Arphaxad from northern Syria, from the land where Abraham came from. That's my opinion on the Kassites or the Chaldeans. So their language was very similar, Aramaic. Any magician or astrologer or Chaldean, that might mean that when the Chaldeans had conquered Babylon, that they left a lot of the traditional Canaanite magicians and astrologers in place. We don't know, but they didn't kill them all. That they basically subsumed them. That's about all I have to say about the first 12 or 13 verses. I think it was 12 or 13. Noble?
Sure. Okay, verse 14. Then Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, which was gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree so hasty from the king? Then Arioch made the thing known to Daniel. Then Daniel went in and desired of the king that he would give him time and that he would show the king the interpretation. Then Daniel went to his house and made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret, that Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. And he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom unto the wise, and knowledge to them that know understanding. He reveals the deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. I thank you and praise you.
Noble.
Yeah, we might have to wait a minute. Oh, you can read it, Bill.
User in your channel timed out.
23.
I don't know what happened to him, but he dropped out. He'll be, let's see if he's next.
Yeah, his computer just crashed. Sorry, guys.
Okay. I forgot Kind Sheep was Noble's wife, I'm guessing.
Yep. He'll be back soon.
Okay.
Well,
let me see where we are. Where are 23? I thank thee and praise thee, that O thou God of my fathers, who has given me wisdom and might, and has made known unto me now what we desired of thee, for thou hast now made known unto us the king's matter. Daniel's actually saying all this in advance before he reveals it. So he's expressing his confidence in what he's received from God, and he's speaking on the king's terms because he's using a word for God that's very much like Hebrew, but in the text, it's an Aramaic form. He's using a Hebrew word for God without saying the word Yahweh, probably because the king wouldn't understand the references to Yahweh, or he might be offended by it. Daniel's just using the generic term for God in order to speak on the same terms as the king, terms that would be amenable to the king because he is the king, right? So, therefore, Daniel went unto Arioch, whom the king had ordained to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus unto him, destroy not the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show unto thee, unto the king, the interpretation. Then Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste and said thus unto him, I have found a man of the captives of Judah that will make known unto the king the interpretation. The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name or title was Belteshazzar, art thou able to make known unto me the dream which I have seen and the interpretation thereof? Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king has demanded cannot the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers show unto the king, but there is a God in heaven. There he goes, the same Aramaic term for God. In heaven it reveals secrets and makes known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the later days. Thy dream and the visions of thy head upon thy bed are these. And I will leave it there. Noble's back. And I don't know if there's anything to discuss here that I haven't already made remarks on, because I can't help myself but to make remarks while I read. I just can't. Not even during my own podcast.
I apologize, guys. My computer's
right.
A piece
of shit. You can't help your computer. I mean,
shit.
It's not your fault you're using Windows and it crashes all the time. No, I'm kidding.
So where are we?
Do we have anything to discuss? Probably not.
Where did you leave off, Bill?
I think the biggest thing to notice here is the confidence that Daniel had that this was revealed to him. And his even speaking about the king's own wise men and magicians, that they're basically of no account.
Right.
Because the God of heaven wouldn't make these things known to them. He made them known to Daniel. So Daniel's actually kind of belittling the wise men of the king. He's really belittling them. And that's got to make an impression on the king. If Daniel doesn't nail it, he's going to lose his head for that. So... he must have had quite a bit of confidence.
So at verse 20, where it is, so after it was revealed to Daniel in a night vision, Daniel answered and said...
I guess Noble can continue from verse...
I don't think
Bill can hear us. Well, can't we discuss...
where I stopped, 29?
I don't think Bill can hear any of us. Can you, Bill? Yeah.
28. Is Noble still here, or is he still?
I'm here. I'm just. Joe was saying something.
Yeah, hold on. It's Bill that's the problem now.
Yeah, because
he can't hear us. On mute.
I guess right. My sound died.
He'll
my speaker
out.
Died. I don't know why.
Computer problems all around.
No, my speaker just died. I had to reset it in my software, but this isn't Windows, so my computer didn't crash or I didn't have to reboot. I'm kidding.
All right, so can you hear us now?
I'm sorry.
So at verse 20, it says, so after he has the dream, the night vision, he blesses the God of heaven. Then in verse 20, he says, Daniel answered and said, so where it says he answered, is he answering Arioch like the next day or something?
No, in verse 27, he's answering where the king asked him a question in verse 26.
No, 20, because Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever. And that's the Aramaic, not the Aramaic, the, what is the language of the Chaldeans?
Of the Chaldeans is Aramaic. It appears that Daniel is speaking these things because he hasn't even seen Arioch yet. It appears that he must be speaking these things only for the benefit of those around him. Daniel is a member of the court, so he probably does have a lot of Babylonians around him when he's saying these things. And he's speaking to his companions as well in verse 17. But he must have others around him that he's speaking for their benefit. But he's speaking in Aramaic terms. He's the Aramaic word for God appears throughout this discourse, which is Elah instead of simply El or Elohim to pluralize it with the plural majesty in the Hebrew tradition. Here's just Elah and it's a singular.
Speaking of Aramaic, I don't know how true this is. But my Bible, which I'm looking at right now, has a little footnote saying that the middle section of Daniel was written in Aramaic, and that fact is noteworthy, it says. And it says to verse 4 to chapter 7, verse 28. Now, I don't know if you know that's true or not.
Well, there is a lot of Aramaic words throughout Daniel. I'm not sure what their boundaries are. I've heard different theories on it. But I don't know why. I never heard that there weren't Aramaic words throughout Daniel. So I don't know if there aren't Aramaic words in chapters 8 through 12. or that's only written in Hebrew? I would imagine a lot of this account is probably recorded by others on Daniel's behalf, perhaps on his friend, the scribe, on Daniel's behalf.
Was Aramaic spoken at Daniel's time, or was that after?
Oh, no, Aramaic was the lingua franca of the Babylonians.
Okay.
And the Persians. And the Persians. The Persians spoke Persian, but they used Aramaic for all their official functions and official communications.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of those communications, like their monuments, were recorded in two or three languages, right? Like the Behistun Rock is a Persian inscription, and it's in Elamite and Aramaic and I think Akkadian or Assyrian. And that was how Sir Henry Rawlinson was able to decode a lot of the Assyrian, because he was comparing the three languages. And it helped him figure out Assyrian cuneiform.
Well, I guess it makes sense that we see Aramaic here then, because Daniel lived in the times of both the Persians and the Babylonians.
Yes. Yes, and that's fine. And I don't think this was written all by Daniel. It was probably pieced together later, and probably one or more of his companions helped in the writing of it.
Sort of how like Baruch helped with Jeremiah.
Yeah.
And Bill, you were saying while Noble was gone that Daniel wouldn't have wanted to offend the king of Babylon, so he would have referred to God with Aramaic words.
Right, a generic Aramaic term, yes. He was using the generic Aramaic term here, and probably for the benefit of those around him, in my opinion.
So on verse 29.
Yeah, I can continue. I just hope my computer doesn't crash on me again. Verse 29. As for thee, O king, thy thoughts came into thy mind upon thy bed, what should come to pass hereafter. And he that reveals secrets makes known to thee what shall come to pass. But as for me, this secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have more than any living, but for their sakes that shall make known the interpretation to the king, and that thou might know the thoughts of thy heart. Thou, O king, sawest and behold a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. This image's head was of fine gold, his breast and his arms of silver, his belly and his thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and broke them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain, and filled the whole earth. This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. Thou, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given thee a kingdom, power, and strength and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven has he given into thine hand, and has made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold. And after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaks in pieces and subdues all things, and as iron that breaks all these, shall it break in pieces and bruise. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron. The kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And whereas thou saw iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave to one another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom, which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter. And the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure. End of verse 45.
Yeah, you know, there's probably a lot to discuss here, which we could spend the next 15, 20, 30 minutes discussing. I don't really care. There's one thing I wanted to address here, because I've been looking at the Hebrew forms of these words, and that's the claim that all of this is written in Aramaic, and to me, that's just simply bullshit. It's not true. It's the Aramaic forms. The forms that they're saying are Aramaic are so much like the Hebrew forms that there's no difference. And I'll just point out a few words and illustrate that. The word for God used throughout this chapter is Allah. And there is a definite spelling difference, because in Hebrew, Yahweh is usually addressed as Elohim, which is plural, a plural form. It's a plural of majesty. It's one God addressed with a plural title in order to elevate him above other gods in the concept of the speaker. That's the an ancient use of a plural that's known from ancient Hittite inscriptions and things like that, so as well as from the Hebrew Bible. So Elohim is Aleph, and it's like A-L H, the ha, and a yod, and an M, Elohim. And God in singular in Hebrew is just L, A-L, two letters, Aleph and Lamech, I think it is, or Lamed, whatever that, Lamed, which is the L. So A-L, well, here it's A-L-ha, A-L-H, so it's Elah is the way that might be pronounced. So it's definitely a different form. But a lot of these other words are spelled exactly like they are in Hebrew. And even Strong says Aramaic. And the only real difference is the vowel pointing. The vowel points were not used until the Masoretic rabbis made the Masoretic text. Like after the 3rd century AD, 4th century AD, those vowel points started to be used. And that's the only distinguishing factor here. Distinguishing these Hebrew words from Aramaic is a vowel point. And get out of here. That's ridiculous.
So yeah, I never trust anything I read in my print Bibles.
Yeah, here the word for children of men is Ben, and it's sons of men, right? But there's no differences with the Hebrew word Ben for son, except the fact of the vowel points. So I'm not going to buy that this is all Aramaic, because it's the same. It's a plural for Ben. It just has different vowel points than Benny in Hebrew. It's got different vowel points that are saying, oh, that's Aramaic. And I would say, oh, get the hell out of here with your vowel points. Stuff them. For real. So I don't know if there's any other differences in the grammar, but I want to see significant differences, not just a vowel point. Ain't going to convince me of nothing. That's some rabbinical hocus pocus as far as I'm concerned. But I just want to hit on that for a moment. Whether or not any other words have definite Aramaic forms, I don't know. I don't have time to study this all in one little Bible lesson, like study like we're doing. But the word God does definitely have an Aramaic form, or at least a different form than where we see everywhere else in scripture, which I can accept as Aramaic. So that's fine. That being said, a lot of critics of Daniel, especially Jewish critics of Daniel, claim that he couldn't have prophesied this, that this helps to show that he didn't live until the 3rd century BC or the 2nd century BC. And even if they're right, then how did he prophesy the fall of Rome?
Or to 70 weeks.
Right, or to 70 weeks or a few other things. So that's still pretty damn good. But the fact is, and we'll get into it, I think it's in Daniel chapter 4, that Daniel knew things about Babylon that the Greeks didn't know. The later Greek Hellenistic writers did not know. So, and they had different versions, and Daniel's version was proven right by archaeology. So it's, I think that's where he gives Nebuchadnezzar credit for building Babylon in, I think it's in Daniel chapter 4. And that wasn't actually proven until Sir Leonard Woolley dug Babylon out of the damn ground and found bricks with Nebuchadnezzar's inscription on them, with his name on them, a stamp that said that attributed the bricks to Nebuchadnezzar, the bricks that the city were made with. He found Nebuchadnezzar's name on them. So that's how we know that Daniel was right, that Nebuchadnezzar did build or rebuild Babylon, where the Greeks thought that Semiramis built Babylon. Herodotus thought that, and all the Hellenistic period writers attributed the building of Babylon to Semiramis, who was a goddess, but who was probably really the wife of an 8th century BC Assyrian king with a very similar name. So it's probably a commemoration of her. And I believe that's true. So Semiramis didn't build Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar did. His name is on the bricks, not the name of Semiramis, right? So Daniel is actually verified in a lot of that archaeology. And it was information that Hellenistic Greeks didn't have. So Daniel couldn't have written during the Hellenistic period. He must have written earlier. And even Comparé did a sermon on that.
Don't the Jews have a bias that they would want Daniel to be spurious?
Yes, they hate Daniel because of the 70 weeks prophecy and the foretelling of the destruction of Jerusalem and the coming of the Messiah. They hate Daniel for that reason alone. They want to discredit Daniel so that people don't see that the prophets of God are true.
Yeah, they'll put a black cloth over Daniel 9.
Right. And they do, when they read Daniel on rare occasion, they do put a black cloth over certain portions of Daniel.
I just think academics should be more critical of what the Jews say, realizing that they have this bias. So right. They shouldn't just accept it when they say, oh, that spirit, we don't want to believe that. They should say, maybe it's because you hate Christ. Maybe you've got some sort of agenda here.
Yeah, Paul warned them about that a long time ago.
Yeah, you know, there are some Christian academics which understand that the Jewish interpretations are wrong, but they don't consider the implications and make the right conclusions.
Right. Yeah, why do the Jews hate Isaiah so much that they have to split it in two?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a joke, yeah. And we can see here that iron doesn't cleave to clay. So you've got these strong kingdoms, the gold kingdom. It was united, I guess. It was stronger than these mixed kingdoms that you're just never going to last. Seems a lot of what applies to Rome applies to us today.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And Rome, yeah, being the biggest kingdom, was the most mixed kingdom. It's cleared it, it would have had the greatest degree of clay mixed in with the iron.
Didn't we see a mini example of iron not mixing with clay when Yugoslavia fell apart?
I'm not really certain of the ethnic composition of Yugoslavia. I'm really kind of, I mean, I thought both groups were Slavs.
Microphone activated.
Well, yeah, I mean, they were, even the Macedonians.
Yeah, I know the Macedonians are Slavs, definitely.
They all there were more than two. There was five. There were six groups, but essentially there's four, because three of them are just three Serbian countries that were created into one. So it's, but I think if you mean like with ethnic groups, yeah. But I think that this is kind of has a double meaning, though. It's both ethnic groups and racial groups, this play, right?
Yeah, I guess, like, I thought there were some tears, though, in Yugoslavia, like the Bosnians and the Albanians.
Yeah, well, the Albanians were in the southern part of Kosovo, and yes, they're all tears. But in Bosnia, they're not. It's more like around probably 50-50 or 40% tears. They're just in the two large cities. And then all over the countryside, it's Serbians and Croatians. And they had enclaves that were wouldn't even mix with each other. They wouldn't even mix with each other, never mind the Muslims.
Right, right. Yeah, I don't want to make us digress too much. I was just thinking of it.
Daniel is ambiguous here, because where it says, wheresoever the children of men dwell, the word is Enosh. It's the same spelling as the Hebrew term Enosh, even though there's different vowel pointing. So they claim it's Aramaic, but that's bullshit. The word is Enosh, and it simply refers to mortal men, regardless of race. And it says, wheresoever the children of men dwell, and that's the word Enosh. But then further on, it says that they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, as if there was something wrong with that, right? And it must be, they must be the Romans, because this is their empire that's being forecast. They were the ones that were the fourth kingdom from this time. It was the Chaldeans were the head of gold. And what followed them was the Persian Empire, which was made up of Media Persia, Persians and Medes, two nations that formed a confederacy. And they were the two arms of silver, one arm being Persians and the other being Medes, and that makes sense. And then the third kingdom was the Greek Empire of Alexander, which did bear rule over all the earth, is all the land, because they didn't rule over China or Africa, sub-Saharan Africa or South America or anything like that. It's all the land, which is the land of basically the Genesis 10 nations, the Adamic race. And then the Romans, the fourth kingdom, shall be as strong as iron and break in pieces and subdue all things, which it did. It subdued all, meaning all of those previous empires. And it says that they fall because they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men. And that word is Enosh again. But they must be referring to the Romans, who are actually descended from the ancient children of Israel. It's demonstrable to a great degree. So it's ambiguous, but where the word Enosh is set in contradistinction to an Adamic group, we have to understand that those Enosh are not the men of the covenant, the men with the spirit and blessings of God, or however you want to interpret that. But mingling themselves with the seed of Enosh to me indicates men without a spirit, and that's why they're clay in this context. But it's a different, it has to be interpreted as being a different context than the same word where it's used in Daniel 2:38.
You know, so, go ahead, Bill.
It's arguable, but the context demands that Enosh is a different group than they, which must refer to the Romans.
Some people might raise an objection with 238 and say, wherever the children of men dwell, well, that could mean all people, since all people can be Enosh. Therefore, you know, this includes not just the Adamic world, but it could include, you know, all the world and all the people in it, because it's got Enosh there. But then why even make a distinction is my thoughts. Why even say where the children of men dwell if that's the meaning? You know, I don't know what a good response to that would be, though.
The good response is, how do you know that the non-white races were actually considered Enosh? We do know that the Nephilim and certain of the Canaanites were considered Enosh, but they had Adamic blood. The Nephilim, not necessarily. But they were fallen angels. They weren't sub-Saharan Africans. The children of men, if Nebuchadnezzar ruled wherever the children of men dwell, then where the children of men dwell is where Nebuchadnezzar ruled. And that didn't include China or North and South America or sub-Saharan Africa.
Somebody was saying earlier how the U.S. and or today and Rome has so many similarities, and I kind of look at it as the iron and clay here in North America, that we're now mixed with iron and clay, and this is the center of the empire.
Well, right, but it's a new empire in different times. It's just that history always repeats itself because we never learn the lessons of history.
Yeah, and it's just yet another similarity, how everything that's happened specifically to the main power of the earth, now happening to the main power of the earth today.
It's like those eternal truths that just can't change, and the Jews never can understand those truths, and so they keep trying to do the same thing again, or men, like the Tower of Babylon incident. They're always trying to, you know, the same errors over and over again. Like, we know iron doesn't mix with clay, yet we're doing it again. Like, why?
Yeah, I mean,
we know Sodom was destroyed, yet we're doing it again. Like, why? And that's a lot more obvious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, to me, the lesson in that is they can't win. They're never going to win. Because if you depart from the laws of God, you're not, that empire will never stand. You've said things like that too, Bill. I remember quoting one of your papers that said that.
Yeah, I said it in The Widening Gulf and the Tolerance of Evil, that no nation has ever survived which was immoral.
Yeah, that's right. They won't.
It just took Rome probably 350 years to fall after it began to openly accept such immorality.
Yeah, well, I think America will fall, you know, the West will probably fall a lot quicker, since we're a lot more mixed up and a lot more sinful. We've got a lot more going on.
Right. I don't know how many trannies there were in ancient Rome. I mean, there were some. I mean, Nero kind of promoted it. And there were those Jews that Herodotus wrote about in the Galilean desert who were dressing up as women and attacking men. Wow.
That's such a cowardly move, hey, because you'd probably let your guard down. Oh, they're just women. Yeah, don't worry about them. And then suddenly they're attacking. You're like, what? That's such a cowardly move.
Yeah, it is. Yes, it is.
I guess there were bandits, right?
Yeah, the Sicarii. Some of the Sicarii were dressing up in drag and attacking men.
Checks out. So when the Germanics destroy Rome, it says here that the kingdom will never have an end. And it sort of reminds me of how Christ says he won't exhaust the cities of Israel until the Son of Man comes.
Right. And this definitely has to refer to Germanic tribes, because they're the ones that destroyed Rome. And a lot of Roman Catholics argue that, no, it's talking about the Catholic Church. But the Roman Catholic Church was formed under blessings by Rome.
Yeah, they didn't destroy Rome either.
No, there was no attempt of the church to destroy Rome. Okay, maybe Justinian or Constantine. I think it was a little later. I think it was like Justinian's time, Theodosian I maybe, when all the last of the pagan temples in Greece and the schools of pagan philosophy had been closed. That was kind of late. That was maybe 5th or 6th century. But that's not destroying Rome. That's only replacing Rome with Roman Catholicism. Or what's left of Greek philosophy with Roman Catholicism. No, the church as an institution never sought to destroy Rome. They only sought to control Rome and to become Rome, which is what they did.
In Revelation, that's how it's described too.
Right.
You know, comes out of the dead. You know, I forget what I can't even paraphrase it now.
It's the head which grew up out of the first beast.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. Can we read?
And we
the
see
last
it here in
verses?
Daniel too.
What was that?
Can we read the last four verses?
Sorry, he just. What was it, Noel?
Sorry, I was just saying we see it here in Daniel 2 of the little horn.
Right, there's allusions to it here as well, and it's the same symbology we see in Revelation.
Sorry, Joe.
Well, there's some good stuff in the last four verses that connects with 45. You know, 46, then the king of Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and worshipped Daniel and commanded that they should offer an oblation and sweet odors unto him. The king answered unto Daniel and said, of a truth it is, that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, seeing that thou couldest reveal this secret. Then the king made Daniel a great man and gave him many gifts and made him ruler over the province, whole province of Babylon, and chief of the governors over all the wise men of Babylon. Then Daniel requested of the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel sat in the gate of the king. And I just love that part. I love those two parts where it says, and the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure. And then the king of Babylon fell upon his face. I love that bit. Because you can just imagine, like, Daniel's very confident, and the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure, and the king falls upon his face. Yeah, recognizing the truth of God, you know, this is a noble kingdom. Yeah, I mean, it's not as noble as the Holy Kingdom, but you can see that at least this kingdom was a kingdom where the king was at least able to, you know, acknowledge the true God.
Well, right. Babylon was, it was pagan, but that doesn't make it 100% evil. Paganism alone, you having the wrong religion, doesn't really make you evil. It's silly to think that way. It's very Roman Catholic or Southern Baptist or Greek Orthodox to think that way. Having the wrong religion doesn't make you evil by itself, even if that religion had some unseemly practices like Baal worship did. That doesn't make a man totally evil.
True evil is genetic.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
That's the true definition of good and evil. What right. comes from God is good, even if it, you know, even if it goes astray a little bit. And what doesn't come from God, that's what true evil is. And so at the beginning of this, it says that Nebuchadnezzar is a king of kings. And then you've got the king of kings saying, of a truth, it is that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings. So it's sort of answering the thing like Christ is the true king of kings. Even the king of Babylon, who was said to be a king of kings, recognizes that.
Well, this prophecy, regardless of when you want to believe Daniel lived, which I believe was during the time of the Book of Nezar, right? I mean, this had to happen by its own profession. This happened in the third year or in the first year of the Book of Nezar. I'm sorry, I forget what verse 1 said already. In the second year of the Book of Nezar. So the events in Susanna must have happened in the first year of the Book of Nezar, very soon after Daniel was brought to Babylon. They had to, even though they really seem to describe a later time, because certain men of the captivity are already very wealthy. So that might be that might actually contradict my own belief that Susanna happened at a very early time, but I'm not going to let it bother me. I believe it did happen in early time. This is the second year of Nebuchadnezzar, if that interpretation is of the year of Nebuchadnezzar, that phrase is the correct one. This is at a very early time. And Daniel, living at this time, actually foresaw the fall of Rome to this stone cut out of the mountain without hands, and they are the people of God. There should be no doubt to any theologian that this is describing the Germanic tribes. And any other interpretation is ludicrous and denies the truth and the simplicity of this prophecy that came true. So if all this prophecy came true and you're denying that this is describing the Germanic tribes, the denial is 100% contrary to what Daniel writes here, and you're actually denying God.
Also, the Catholic Church is universalist, so it's also iron mixed with clay. So how can it be any different to the Roman Empire that was broken?
So the whole fabric of the Roman Catholic Church stands, and all the other so-called Christian churches, stands in direct contradiction to the prophets of God and to this chapter of Daniel. And there's many other ways that we'll see as we go through, well, we already went through them. So this is the last major prophet we have to cover here, but we've already seen it many times in Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel. Maybe we didn't discuss it on those same terms, but it's very clear here in Daniel that the Germanic tribes had destroyed Rome and broke it into pieces, and they did. Rome was, it's actually described by Procopius that after the Goths invaded Rome, there were only a couple of dozen Romans left in the whole city. And the Goths controlled all of Italy for quite some time until they were finally defeated by Belisarius, who was the leading general of the Byzantine Empire. So Rome was broken in pieces. And the rest of the empire was broken in pieces. And even though the Byzantines managed to recapture Italy, they could still never recapture the rest of the empire. They recaptured part of North Africa and most of Italy, but not all of it. And part of Iberia, which was very short-lived. And they couldn't recover the rest of the empire. It was broken in pieces forever, just like Daniel said it would be. And the Germanic tribes filled it up, just like Daniel said. And the Germanic tribes did fill up the Roman Empire at the time this happened. They occupied North Africa. They occupied Iberia. They occupied Gaul, and it became known as France. They occupied Britain, and it became known as England. So yeah, they occupied it all. A lot of people don't understand in history that the Saxons and the Vandals and the Franks and other groups shifted west in the 5th century and 6th centuries after the fall of Rome, and the Anglo-Saxons invaded England, even though many of the Angles and the Saxons stayed behind in Germany, and they actually took over big chunks of what was the former Roman Empire, and there were major population shifts in Germany from east to west during that period of time. If you read the Nibelungenlied, which is from the late 4th or early 5th century AD, probably late 4th century AD, because it speaks of the life of events which happened during the life of Attila the Hun. So if you read the Nibelungenlied, which is a German poem, the Franks were in Worms, which is in the Rhineland in Germany. And those Franks in Worms were called the Burgundians. And then after the 5th century, the Saxons invaded that portion of Germany. And the Burgundians went all the way down into Gaul in central France. And they're found in central France from that time. There was a whole population shift from east to west at that time. And that was Germanic tribes pouring into portions of the Roman Empire, just like Daniel said it's here, that they would fill the empire.
You could, would you cross-reference that to Isaiah 27:6? He shall cause them that come out of Jacob to take root. Israel shall blossom and bud and fill the face of the world with fruit. And that's speaking of, I think that's speaking of the kingdom of God coming. And so
that's one fulfillment of Isaiah 27:6. That's one stage in that fulfillment, yes. Yes, well, that should be a good cross-reference.
I could, like what we were saying before, like what we live under today is sort of similar to Rome. And so if you're reading Daniel 2:35, then was the iron, clay, the brass broken to pieces together and became like chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away. That's kind of what's going to happen when Babylon falls, is all these, you know, we have this mixed kingdom now, but all that will be blown away. All the tares will be burned and swept away, and we shall establish a kingdom that lasts forever. So it's sort of a shadow of what's to come when Babylon falls.
Yeah, I wouldn't say sort of, I'd say exactly.
And the stone that smote image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. That's like the promise to Abraham, and that reads a lot like Isaiah 27:6.
Right, and I interpret that as filling the whole land, and the Goths and the other Germanic tribes did fill the whole land that had been formerly occupied by the Roman Empire. Except that they didn't return to Palestine, not until the Crusades, and that was very temporary. But that's because there's other prophecies, and you pointed out one of those yourself the other day in the chat, Joe, about a hedge being put up so that Israel could not return to Palestine. It's in Hosea.
Yeah, all the thorns there, you know, the mixed race people, they're all thorns. You don't want to go into their land, you know. That's why we don't go back there, is because they're subhuman hellholes where they just do things that we can't even imagine. We don't want to know what goes on in the Arab countries. We don't want to go back, you know, move through all the thorns to get into some hellhole.
Right. It's the Canaanites that are described as thorns earlier in Scripture, in Deuteronomy, Numbers, Judges. It's in there a few times. Therefore, behold, Hosea 2:6, I will hedge up thy way with thorns and make a wall, speaking of Israel, that she shall not find her paths, and she shall follow after her lovers, meaning the other nations, but she shall not overtake them. So Israel was prevented from going back to Palestine with any degree of permanency.
And they are pricks in your eyes. Like, as soon as you look at them, they're pricks in your eyes. So they're hedging up the way with thorns. You just look back and they're pricks in your eyes. You're like, I'm not going back there. Just looking at them. I don't know, Bill. Sorry. Didn't mean to cut you off there, bro.
No, that's fine. We can leave it there. We'll be back next week with Daniel chapter 3.